Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel. I feel you're going to stay. Lonely nights that come, memories that flow, bringing you back again, hurting me more and more.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. I'd like to welcome you to this program. It's all about empowering people by making more reasoned and, well, just common sense choices. For example, a new study from Nagoya University Graduate School of Medicine and published in a major peer-reviewed journal, Science, shows how stress can cause a fever. Okay, why is that important? I'll give you an insight into that when we talk about the coronavirus a little later. Also today, I'm going to go through a couple of the ideas that will help everyone who's staying at home or possibly out of work, because I think we need a discussion on this. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. Then I'll end the show with about a 25-minute original investigative report challenging a recent TED Talk by a highly respected clinician scientist in genetics, who's a professor at Columbia University, has a division there, who's published in peer-reviewed literature, so she has all the right credibility. But she made a statement, and when I was watching this TED Talk that was sent to me by someone, she emphatically states there is no relationship between vaccines and autism. All right, that it's all genetic. Okay, well, I disagree. And so for the last 24 hours, Richard Gale and I have been reviewing the world scientific literature, and we found many articles, high-quality professional studies that show, indeed, there are associations between autism and neurological damage to the brain, including from the aluminum adjuvant that's put into vaccines. And we're going to share that with you. But also, we're going to give you a little discussion about genetics. I won't spend a lot of time talking about genetics, because if you don't have a background in it, it won't A, be understood, or B, be interesting. But the 90% of the discussion we're going to have is in the article, and the article is posted on prn.fm. Please download it. This is about vaccines and honoring the life experiences of millions of Americans who are now living with a vaccine-damaged child. Now, think of how difficult it is for them to be in quarantine. It's one thing where you can go to your computer, you can watch something relevant and productive, or something that just is a waste of time. You can use your time to create, or you can use your time for nothing. But if you have a vaccine-damaged child, where that child has to have 24/7 care, and now you have to take care of your child 24/7, and you can't take him outside. Well, think of how challenging that is. And also, haven't we, for the past at least 30 years, had various campaigns to look for the truth? And instead of having an ideology or a belief that we accept as the truth, look for it wherever it's at. So when millions of parents have said, my child was normal until they were vaccinated, then they descended into the abyss, into a place that where they couldn't communicate or maintain eye contact, where they were going through repetitive motions like banging their head or screaming inconsolably or diarrhea for 10 hours a day. Those people are telling the truth. And for those children to dismiss all of them as being genetic, and yet other children, 2, 3, 4 other children in the same families who did not have a reaction, and yet those children did. Or other children who had reactions, so they didn't vaccinate their latest child, and that child ended up normal. That's not genetic. That's environmental. And one of the primary exposures in the environment are vaccines, and not just the mercury, but rather all the other toxic ingredients. And all the ingredients in vaccines are toxic. So for all of you, this will be a primer. Now, why is that important for those of you who don't have children or aren't vaccinated? Because there's a high probability, not a certainty, but a probability, that the California effort that succeeded in eliminating all exemptions for vaccination, except for medical, and that's almost impossible to establish. In fact, doctors giving, some 60 doctors in California who were allowing for medical, legitimate medical exemptions, they're under attack now. This is totalitarian. This is fascism in medicine at its worst. This is medical McCarthyism at its worst. So now they want to go for adults, meaning that the same extremely irresponsible and dangerous vaccine mandated schedule they're giving for their children with terrible side effects, they want every single person to take. There is no science, zero. Unless you're a corrupt politician accepting money from these people, you're a completely captured journalist supporting this initiative, or you're a manufacturer and you have no morals or ethics to begin with, so you're just profiteering. That's how bad it's got. Now, what do you think is going to happen when they claim to come up with a coronavirus and because of the pandemic mandate that all people, children and adults, take it? Then you're going to see the side effects of that. So that's why be aware of how wrong they are about everything when it comes to vaccines. That's coming at you today. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. According to the Nagoya University Graduate School of Medicine, psychological stress can trigger physiological responses, including increase in body temperature, and they've discovered the neural circuit that underlies this stress-induced heat response, and it has been identified. Now, this is something brand new. I remember, and I'll give you an example of this. I remember in junior high school, I went out for the basketball team, and I made the team because I lived with the basketball. That was the one really pleasure, that my bicycle that I valued, because I could ride everywhere. And I loved playing basketball. It would be the middle of winter, and Tom Croft, my buddy that I grew up with from age one, we'd be out there shooting. There'd be snow. We didn't care. We shot. And Bob Cousy, who was the best, one of the best. And that's who I tried to. And so I was good with the basketball. So I went out for the team, made the team, and was one of the point guards because I could shoot and had a very high percentage of accuracy, and I was fast and I could steal balls. And then we had our first game, and I did terrible. I missed every layup. I missed every shot. I had air balls. I was just a mess. And the next game, same thing happened. Then the Coach Kincaid, again, one of those wonderful mentors, he sat down with me and he said, "Gary, when you're in the game, how do you feel?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, what is going on in your mind that in practice you never miss a shot or a layup, and here you're not making a shot or layup?" And I said, "Well, I feel very stressed." "So you have like a performance anxiety?" I said, "Possibly. I don't know what that means." He says, "Well, where you're being judged. You know, people are watching." I said, "Yeah, that's probably it." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what. From now on, I want you to play in the game the same way that you have fun in practice." So it took me a while, as I was young and not terribly bright, to wrap my mind. What did that mean? So in the next game, he just said to me, "Remember, don't be stressed. Just go out there and have fun." And so for about a minute or two, I was stressed. But then I began to have some fun. And I had fun by just dribbling around people and whizzing that ball around and then doing a layup and then another shot and another shot. And I had 93% shooting that day. And it occurred to me, it was like a little epiphany for a young guy. The more relaxed you are in what you do, the better you're going to do it. And for the rest of the season and the next year, that's exactly what I did. And it worked. Jump ahead, New York City, a running race, because my first 10 years of athleticism, I was a runner, and a good runner, not a great runner, but I meddled in a lot of races. I came in, you know, second or third and in my age group. So I felt good about that because there's thousands of athletes to compete against. And you train for what you're capable of doing. But then there was a race, and I'll never forget this, and this is one of these little learning experiences. I went out as I normally would, and I went out fast, and I was one of the leads, probably in the top 50 guys. And we were settling into a nice pace, around a 5:05 pace, just about a 4-minute mile. But I noticed that I was stressed trying to keep up, so I didn't let the lead pack get too far ahead of me. And I got slower and slower. And by the last mile, I'd fallen back to where I was doing like an 8-minute pace. I trained at a 5 to 6 minute pace. And here I'm racing at an 8-minute pace. And then I analyzed and I said, what was different in this race? And what was different was I was stressed. So I did meditation. And then in the next race, I held back, meaning I didn't go up to the front. I went out and I just relaxed. And my mind was relaxed, my breathing was relaxed, my body was relaxed, because that week I'd done some regressive hypnosis with Dr. Roy Glauberman, and then my buddy, who had worked with one of the top people over at the Albert Ellis Center, Dr. Donald Mullins, on focusing upon relaxing into being. And so I was just as relaxed as can be. And then I picked my pace up. After the first mile, I started doing what are called negative splits. You go out slow, and then with each mile, you get a little faster. It worked. And I was right up into where I wanted to be at the end of the race and felt good. Then I shifted over from running, because I was just bored with it after like 200 or 300 races. And I went into race walking. And I wasn't good at all. I was dead last in my first race. Out of 72 athletes, including some in their 70s, and I'm young, and I was a fast runner. In fact, everybody had gone home. That's how slow I was. And in pain, my shins burn, having trouble breathing, because everything is different in race walking. Anyhow, a guy that I didn't know, his name was Nick Madero, very nice guy. He said, we're going to do a race up in Niagara Falls, but don't go out fast. So when that race came, a couple of weeks later, he says, we're going to go out probably dead last. And he had a piece of tape on his arm, and the tape had, white tape had times. He said, these are splits. So each time we hit a mile, we're going to go 15 seconds faster, but we're going to start slow. And immediately I'm thinking, the guys in this race are very fast. They're not going to slow down, and you go slow, you're not going to catch them. He said, well, let's see. So sure enough, the gun went off, and he held me back. He said, hold on, hold on, hold on. Now we go. And we went out slower than I trained. But then at that first mile, he says, let's pick it up. So we got faster. But then he stopped. We didn't go too fast. And the third mile, fourth mile, fifth mile, sixth mile, we just kept picking up the pace. Well, guess what? We both won. We both won a gold medal. Different age groups, but both won. And we beat all the other guys in our age groups. And I felt so at ease. From that day till now, I've done over 600 races. I haven't lost one. World National Championships. The principle was, I don't race tense. I race relaxed. Now, what in the world does that have to do with the coronavirus? And what does that have to do with this study? When we're stressed, our body biochemistry changes, because stress means that we maybe feel imminent danger. And this is not under our control. It is a part of our evolutionary mechanisms to prepare us to live by fighting or fleeing, the fight or flight response. And this way, if you want to get out of a problem quickly, you're able. But another key response is an increase in our body temperature. And therefore, the body cannot differentiate you needing to get out of harm's way immediately, or you're just having a bad day, or you've had an argument, or you're late and you're stressed, you're in a car or subway and you're stressed, or you wake up the next morning after being stressed, having an argument, and you got a sore throat, you got a cold. How many times does that happen to people? All the time. And what's happening is your body is throwing all of its stress hormones into the battle to protect you, not realizing it's just psychological. You're not in any threat of dying. But it doesn't know that. So what if you stay chronically stressed? You're out of work. You don't know how to buy food or pay for rent or medicines, whatever you need. And you're in circumstances beyond your control. Stress. And then it doesn't go away. It stays. And then we learn to adapt to it. So it's like having a five-alarm fire alarm system triggered, and it stays until one day you can't even hear it. You've adapted to it. So that's one of the dangers of stress. So now connect the fact that we also have spikes in blood pressure, sweaty palms, that we can recognize. So stress can cause a heart attack. Stress can cause a stroke. Stress can cause an embolism. But also emotional stress can cause psychogenic fever in many humans. And now they've been able to actually map and prove the neural mechanisms that underlies this phenomena. And that's what this article is about, because they've been able to describe the key neural circuit in psychological induced hyperthermia. So let's take it back to the coronavirus, which means that for all those people who were originally diagnosed with a coronavirus because they had a meter that reads temperature variations on your forehead. Remember, they'd see people walking up to an airport and checking counter, they'd be checked, or people in lines in China initially being checked. And then if they didn't hit the high temperature, they were passed on as if they couldn't be infected. When indeed they could have viruses that were manifesting and seeding throughout their body, mainly the upper respiratory tract, but they had no symptoms, including they didn't have a spike fever. So they went into society on airplanes, trains, subways, buses, cabs, meetings, conferences, concerts, and they were spreading the virus. And that's why viruses are manifesting in waves. Just like I just saw that a plane, chartered plane, by a group of college students, I think it was around 80, went down to Mexico and they partied, came back, disavowed any intent to do the right thing. That's not unusual among young people and college kids in particular. Aren't they all geniuses and perfect? Yeah. No. And so 14 of them showed coronavirus. Now, how many more on that plane are going to show it because they have latent inoculation periods until it manifests symptoms? How many of those people went back and are now infecting their dorm or have infected their dorm or people at home? So you're going to see a second generation of that. How many people, over a million people, went this year to Mardi Gras, right in the middle of all this, the middle of February? You have a million plus people, many of whom already have compromised immune systems, and they're drinking, and they drink a lot at Mardi Gras. It's fun. The music, the people, the energy, the positivity, the food. Some of the best food in the world is Cajun foods. Some of the best music is that Louisiana funk and that Louisiana jazz. But also comes the coronavirus, because these people were not maintaining their distance. So let's start to put some of this stuff together. New Orleans had very few, or Louisiana had very few, coronavirus cases, and now it's spiked in New Orleans. That's the coronavirus. And it's jumping at leaps and bounds. So New Orleans itself, as a city, which is a small city, it's not big, is not highly populated. It is now on pace to catch California as a whole state with 39 million residents in major cities like Los Angeles, who have because in San Francisco and Los Angeles, even Sacramento, you have tens of thousands of homeless people, and they're not quarantining, and their immune systems are non-existent. They're so dilapidated. I can tell you, working with drug addicts for decades at Trafalgar Hospital that was associated with the Institute of Biology, where I was a senior research fellow, I would counsel these people, and they would do a physiological exam or a blood exam. Their blood was like a sewer. Hepatitis, herpes, gonorrhea, chlamydia, Epstein-Barr, Coxsackie, HIV, they had everything in their blood. Now, what do you think is the probability that all those addicts, breathing, defecating, urinating, touching everything, going into stores, do you think that that's going to contribute to the coronavirus? You bet. But the people who stay away in gated communities, they won't manifest that unless they're out there celebrating. And look at all the celebrities who are coming down with coronavirus. Then you have to ask, where'd you get it? Well, in a place where you didn't know someone else had the coronavirus, in a bar, a nightclub, you know, in a party. Because there's a lot of drugs in California with people with suppressed immune system, and alcohol is one of the first things that can suppress your immune system. It's deadly against the immune system. That's why people who are chronic drinkers live shorter lives. That's why their liver and kidneys fail. So, what about people who smoke? Well, that's a big issue too. So, what we're seeing is we're seeing what will probably be three major waves of the coronavirus until enough people are in isolation, enough people start to practice proper and thorough hygiene. When people buy something in a store, they take it home wearing gloves and immediately wash soap and water over it thoroughly for 60 seconds, then spray alcohol, hydrogen peroxide on it, let it sit for 60 seconds, wipe it down before they put it in the fridge. Because you can bet that people who were touching that didn't have protective masks or gloves, and many could have the coronavirus, in which case it could live for days, in some cases weeks, outside the body on surfaces. So only when we become fully aware of what to do and what not to do will we stay safe. And by the way, we are starting our third week of quarantine here at the Anti-Aging Study Group, and not a single person sick, but we planned to have everyone do the maximum super caution. Everybody wears gloves and masks. Everybody has a little ionizer. And we have phenomenal filtration systems that we got that have 7-stage filtration with ultraviolet, every kind of stage. And these are as good as they can get. Everything gets killed in the air with these. And we have them everywhere where we meet. But then we have everybody in their own private room, and we have everybody working outside, power walking and biking and are on some 56 acres here, so we have plenty of room. We don't have to go out. Nobody's off campus. So everybody's in an ideally healthy, clean environment, and they're all doing the protocol properly. And that's the way it should be. Now, if every home did the same thing, there'd be an outbreak. Positive, or at least has symptoms, even if they don't test, because we're not giving the right test. The PCR test. We're not doing the right test for everyone. We're just doing it by symptoms. So let's say someone has some symptoms, but they're not testing them. That's what many hospitals are doing. They don't have the means to do all these tests. Too many people, too few facilities, too few tests. So we're guessing. And then they go home. But what if they are infected? Are they going to have gear that the hospital should, out of ethics and good science and hygiene, give them? How many people in your home? We got four. Two younger, two older, and a fifth. We have a senior, and she has emphysema. She was a heavy smoker. Okay, so you got five people. Let's give them 5 gallons, 5 95 to 99 masks, which are protective, Let's give them gloves, a box of gloves. Wash your hands thoroughly. Wash all surfaces down with. Wash your clothes if you've been outside. But then get outside when you can be away from people. Get that sunlight. Get that exercise. Here's what you drink and eat in order to build up your immune system so that your stronger immune system will always be more protective than a weaker immune system. It's simple science, and there's no controversy over that. None of the above is happening. Zero. What is happening are people are trying to do makeshift because there are no masks, and the masks that exist are very poor. So they're told to make masks out of sweatsuits, even double the sweatsuit. So then you got something approaching a 95. And then all the other hygiene, probably not. So the same person who has the infection is now using the bathroom with everyone else and may even have a toothbrush. Maybe using china to eat off of, porcelain plates instead of, or ceramic, instead of paper. So you see, we have had no good program of hygiene except wash your hands. But just washing your hands and then touching contaminated items, you recontaminate your hands. Well, I washed my hands this morning. And how many things have you touched and then touched your face? Especially if you have a beard. So everything you could do wrong right now, we're doing wrong, except the isolation part. But then how long can people stay isolated before they get cabin fever and then put themselves at risk by going outside? We have to rethink this. Now, let's go to Italy. Specifically, a study that's just come out and a really interesting article written about, and in a qualified article, that talks about, let's take a look at what is happening. And what they're finding is that in the areas where people were dying, they had a 300% higher rate of emphysema and other respiratory tract infections under normal conditions from smoking, heavy smoking. And Italians are heavy, heavy smokers from childhood on. Of course, they have some healthy things in their lifestyle and diet, and that's good. But the idea that you can do a few healthy things and a lot of unhealthy things, you're not going to win that. So now what you have is you have comorbidity, meaning you have a disease present having nothing to do with the virus, but everything to do with a lifetime of bad choices, and it's caught up and it's tipped. Now you're in a medical facility, a hospital or a nursing home or assisted living center or hospice care, or you're being seen as an outpatient at home. Those are the people who died. And almost every single one, the list of reasons for dying was coronavirus. Here's what this study showed. And you haven't heard this before. And our officials should be challenged on their inaccuracy and lack of methodology. Only 15% of the deaths could be attributed directly to the coronavirus. That meant that 85% of 12,400 deaths in Italy were actually due to other causes. Cofactors. So people were dying of cancer that they normally would die of, and heart disease, and stroke, or complications from stroke, or emphysema, or diabetes. These are all common everyday causes of death. And at the national average for every country, these far and away exceed all the deaths in the world for coronavirus. And that's just in one country, Italy. And the average age is 77.2 years, I believe, for the average death in Italy. So wouldn't it make more sense, instead of creating massive panic and then come in with draconian, totalitarian, and virtually police state or martial law principles, if not officially acted, where you say, the coronavirus infects a person. It already has life-ending diseases, and it becomes the tipping point. It tips the immune system to a level the person can't recover, and they die. Then look at other countries that are not even quarantining, like Sweden and the Netherlands and Japan. Why haven't they seen a spike in coronavirus diagnosis or deaths? Many reasons. But one is, they're taking a more measured approach, and Japan has probably the highest in the world qualities of hygiene. They are really hygienic. From birth on, everybody is taught cleanliness. They wear masks all the time under normal circumstances to help limit infections of all kinds, like a normal, let's say, or not a normal, but an average yearly influenza or pneumonia, which are communicable. And people are crowded on subways, five times more crowded in a New York City subway. They actually have pushers. People have these long, they look like a broom with a padding, and they literally push people into the subway and like sardines. Well, if you're taught how to wash your hands all the time, and you're taught to wear gloves, and you're taught to wear masks, and you're taught to understand how to eat and drink to help your immune system, that makes an enormous difference. But then you eliminate the stress from panic. So if you're de-stressed and you're working already on accepting hygiene because it's a normal process of life, you don't wear shoes in the house. I mean, we should be emulating much of what they do hygienically. When children go to school, they clean all the bathrooms and the classrooms. They bleach down tables and floors. They make meals that are actually healthy, not junk meals. So that's one of the reasons, but also because they haven't panicked the public. And up to this point, at least, that's been beneficial to them. Also, don't conflate two separate issues. If a person has the flu or pneumonia and they develop the coronavirus, that in a normal, healthy person would be very, very unlikely to kill them, like 0.1%, 0.1%. But in a person that's older and has multiple life-threatening diseases, then that morbidity or the mortality rate could go up anywhere between 2.2% to 10%, depending upon the population. But then you look at Spain. Spain and Italy are very similar. Similar in the number of people infected and in deaths. But then look at the pullback and look at how many people die from emphysema and flu and pneumonia and heart disease and these other conditions. And again, why blame all that on the coronavirus? Separate out what a person would normally die from and is dying. They will die. And then suddenly you see a more realistic figure. All I'm suggesting is here, we're not being given realistic, honest figures. And without that, as a scientist, as someone who's engaged in a scientific study right now, everyone has to follow the same identical protocol every day. And it's all being monitored as well, not just here, but all around the world. People are monitoring this study. And we have people in my New York office who are sharing the information every day. And that's why all of my lectures are filmed and we ship them up to New York overnight. And then they process them there and then send them out to all these people so they can see how people are faring. And what's interesting, people who came with comorbid conditions, now because of the lifestyle modification, the juicing, the cleansing, the enzyme-rich, the phytonutrient-rich, the antioxidant-rich, all the supplements they're taking, the yoga, the meditation, the journaling, the biking, the gym, the aerobics, the 3 hours around nature every day, suddenly we're seeing a massive improvement in these original underlying conditions. So that means the body's immune system is kicking into high gear in a good way, and therefore they're going to be healthier. So no matter what happens when they get back home, they will be better able to withstand that. Prevention. And we have nothing about preventing using these techniques, but we're seeing that. And I see it in my normal clinical experience on a day-to-day level. So now throw in the last thing, stress. So now, if you go in and say, I've got a temperature, and you've got a temperature, you've got coronavirus, one of the indicating conditions, and you don't have a PCR, and then days later you get the confirmatory statement, no, you don't have PCR, and you don't have any other viruses that are hurting you. You simply had stress, and the stress led to a fever. Ah. And now we have the proof. Science, the current issue of Science Magazine from Nagaoka University Graduate School of Medicine, psychological stress triggers physiological responses, including fever. So now you touch that together. Now go back to what I was saying about basketball. What could you imagine would be the case if I went out to play and before I was playing and I was all nervous because I was afraid, you know, I'm a young kid and didn't want to screw up. If they took my temperature, they're going to say, wow, you got the fever. No, I had stress. The body was simply defending me from that stress until I calmed down and relaxed. What about that race? Oh, wow, Gary, you shouldn't do this race. We just took your temperature and you got the fever. No, I'm stressed. You see, we must bring that piece of a puzzle into the larger picture. It's just one piece of a puzzle, but it's starting to come together. Get honest figures. Take out all comorbid conditions and see what then is the actual cause of death. Instead of giving 100% of the credit for all these people who had the virus and died to just the virus. That is wrong. It's corrupt. It's bad science. It's political science. It's where you use science and pervert it because there's some larger agenda behind this that we're not being told. Just something to think about, all right? And so that we can become more reasonable in how we protect ourselves. And by the way, we're still going forward with the health retreat as a fundraiser for WBAI. And the good news is we will work with each of you who are coming down, either driving or flying. And my daughter just flew in today. And she said, Dad, she said, I was the only one on the plane. I said, good. That's the only time in your life you can say you flew on a private plane. You're the only person on there. And yet, of course, she knew exactly what to do. She knew what nutrients to take beforehand, colloidal silver, the masks and the hydrogen peroxide in the mat, the gloves, the outfit, everything. The plane I flew down that protects themselves correctly. So this is probably one of the safest, cleanest, most enjoyable, beautiful places. Everything is flowering. So if you want to join us for 1 or 2 weeks, it's coming up, and we're going forward because we're here, you know, and everyone here is healthy. Everyone's gone through their quarantine. But then they asked yesterday, can we keep the quarantine going? I said, sure. So they're keeping their masks on, and it has not inhibited a single thing. My hours, my lectures every night during the daytime, our cooking classes, our sprouting, everybody's eating the sprouting, watching the greenhouse go up and having classes on everything you can imagine, exercising, yoga. Everyone's doing everything. And they're just, I couldn't ask for a more delightful and nice group of people. So I'm going to ask, right now, well, let me give you the number. You can call Luann Panessa if you want to join us. Because if you want to get out of your cabin fever and you want to get into a really healthy environment, and if you want to build up your immune system, and if you want to de-stress, give Luann a call. 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. We're having a grand time. Who says that a scientific clinical study has to be boring or humorless? No, we're laughing. We're with nature. We're watching swans. We're watching guinea hens run all over the place. We're petting donkeys. And yeah, we're in quarantine. No one goes off the property. But hey, when you got everything good on one side of the equation, why risk putting yourself at exposure and end up being infected? So no one infected. When the topic of autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders arises, and when parents seek answers for why their child is a victim of these lifelong debilitating conditions, the entire medical community speaks with one voice. It's genetic. It's a defective gene, or genes. Indeed, as we will discuss in a moment, for many cases, autism is hereditary. That is acknowledged. But for many others, it is equally plausible that these neuropathologies are environmental and often due to vaccines. And we have overwhelming evidence. Not only does the media champions the theory of genetic determinism, it also disparages and ridicules and mocks those with a different perspective. In particular, their attacks target parents who experienced a normal child descending into autism's abyss after being vaccinated. Part of the problem is the enormous power the pharmaceutical and vaccine industry holds over our entire healthcare system. They control the national narrative. This cognitive disconnect manifests in the outright dismissal of your personal testimonies and experiences from parents and even pediatricians and doctors with vaccine-injured children. During the past 30 years, efforts to marginalize and silence mothers of autistic children have been remarkably successful. In effect, it is the old hierarchical order of medical patriarchy that has caused the power and authority to be entrusted in them alone. Parents are relegated as irrelevant and their testimonies as worthless and anecdotal. All we need to do is reflect back at the Reagan administration when in 1986 the National Children's Vaccine Act was signed into law. Immediately afterwards, a frenzy of new vaccines began to be developed. More vaccines were added to the national vaccine schedule. Profits soared and vaccine injuries and autism increased. Since then, all of the whistleblowers within the vaccine community, including physicians and scientists, as well as outside the industry investigative journalists, who have documented the relationship between vaccines and neuropathy, have been dismissed entirely. The consequence has been the emergence of a new medical McCarthyism and the dogma the pro-vaccine establishment that controls the plot dictates that autism is only about genetics, but they are wrong. Today, large amounts of funding is going towards research to identify and isolate genetic causation of autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. While there is very sound and convincing research to indicate that many cases of autism are indeed associated with certain genetic anomalies in parents, this view barely scratches the surface of the entire story. Studies investigating twins where autism has been indicated do confirm that this adverse neurodevelopmental condition can be inherited. Nevertheless, even among identical twins, only 77% show autism, which raises the question, what about the remaining 23%? That's just in twins, by the way. Among fraternal twins, the rate is 31%. One convincing empirical example is the case of a New York sperm donor who fathered about 20 children, half had autism. This is a statistically significant case showing that a person can be a carrier of one of the potential 400 genes that have now been identified to autism. But what about the many, many cases where there is no history of autism in a family, nor is there any parental genetic inheritance? This is a common obstacle in studies and analysis that attempt to determine autism's genetic causation. Many genetic findings, in fact, point to de novo mutations, which are mutations that frequently occur during gestation, but are not coded nor inherited from either parent. Such mutations occur spontaneously. A professor, Ivan Izovov, specializes in the role of spontaneous mutations as a cause for autism at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. According to the doctor, quote, every child has some spontaneous mutations, but in some unlucky children, these mutations severely affect the functioning of a particular gene. In fact, these mutations are associated with half of all cases in families where one child is diagnosed with autism. And this raises the issue of epigenetic or environmental factors in a significant cohort of autistic people, meaning something other than a defective gene of the parent caused the autism. There can be numerous possible environmental causes that may contribute to these mutations, like toxic chemicals in the mother, disturbances in the regulatory function of the fetal gene expression, microDNA regulation, and gene splicing events. Other epigenetic effects are like viral infections, pharmaceutical drugs taken during pregnancy, vaccinations, toxic particulate matter in the atmosphere, such as those living near a coal-burning plant, where autism rates are higher than the national average. Such fossil fuel plants emit mercury and other toxic heavy metals. So humanity continues to evolve, or de-evolve if one prefers, and the rate of mutations through natural selection in the germline seems to be accelerating according to many evolutionary biologists. Some genes and gene regions appear to be evolving notably faster than others, but that is part of the scientific basis. So consequently, we must be extremely cautious whenever we hear someone espouse absolute determinist arguments that declare autism is all genetic and always inherited. Those that embrace this belief are in complete denial about the larger magnitude of the epidemic's causation. The increase in autism from 1 in 10,000 just 40 years ago to 1 in 50 and in boys 1 in 36 cannot be explained by the theory of natural selection. It doesn't fly. It has no legitimacy. Those who focus solely upon hunting down autism genes are like engineers who only measure and chart the spread of radiation from a nuclear power plant leak. They investigate the expansion of contamination in the water and soil, but they never attempt to identify the source of the facility's leak and then remedy the problem. For geneticists looking at autism genes, the solution is to discover new drugs to target the brain's neural pathways. But this is like erecting fences to stop the spread of radioactivity. Fences don't stop because radiation does not honor the limited mathematical model that a fence is a barrier. And hence, we must look more thoroughly for the real causes behind the epigenetic mutations. And yet there is another huge cohort of children with autism spectrum disorder and related neurodevelopmental disorders that are outside the geneticist's research. These are the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of children who are vaccine injured. To date, no major effort has been made to critically evaluate these children under the guidelines of medical research to determine causation. Modern science completely discards subjective human experience unless someone can be quantified and measured, such as a gene. It is otherwise preordained an illusion. But how can it be an illusion when just 40 years ago, 1 in 10,000 and now 1 in 50, and that parallels exactly with the introduction of massive amounts of vaccination. But they choose to dismiss this. Well, one leading proponent of the school of genetic determinism is pediatrician and geneticist Wendy Chung, currently the chief of the Division of Clinical Genetics at Columbia University. Now, during a TED presentation, Chung repeated the standard myth from medical orthodoxy that emphatically rejects the evidence that vaccines can cause some cases of neurodevelopmental disorders that fall within the autism spectrum disorder. Quote, "Let me be very clear," she barked. "Vaccines do not cause autism. There is no credible evidence that vaccines cause autism," end quote. And she was relying upon a chart. Chung also misleadingly told the audience that the mercury preservative thimerosal was removed from vaccines in 1992. Sorry, Dr. Chung, wrong. When in fact it was removed in 2001, a year after the scandalous Simpsonwood conference, when the CDC, the FDA, and the World Health Organization, an executive representing all the vaccine makers, met in secret to deliberate over the CDC's own research showing, yes, indeed, thimerosal, mercury, was likely contributing to the dramatic increase in autism. And during that conference, it was decided to move forward to remove thimerosal in order to be on the safe side. Today, the CDC still recommends that pregnant women receive the flu vaccine, despite it containing 25 micrograms of, you bet, thimerosal. So please correct yourself or edit that TED Talk so it's more accurate. In fact, Chung's disingenuous repositioning in the autism cases starting in 2000, when the preservative was starting to be removed, in our opinion, her presentation was solely deceptive. What epigenetic role might vaccine ingredients have on the incidence of autism spectrum disorder? and the causes of this at the genetic level in fetuses? The late Dr. Paul Patterson of Caltech is highly acknowledged as a leading researcher into the interactions between the nervous and immune systems. Patterson noted that viral and bacterial infections during pregnancy increase the risk of a child developing neurological disorders such as autism. Well, it is therefore outrageous that pregnant women should be vaccinated, thereby increasing the likelihood of receiving viral and bacterial material and DNA in their body, where there is no studies on each individually or all collectively of what it will do to every aspect of that immune system. No studies exist for that. And hence, you end up with viral flare-ups from the vaccines. But the autism vaccine debate was never solely about thimerosal, nor about Andrew Wakefield's paper in The Lancet drawing attention to the MMR vaccine and gastrointestinal inflammation in autistic children. DNA contamination, genetically engineered viral vectors, aluminum adjuvants, and other toxic ingredients all are found in vaccines, and they've all, every single one, been implicated in the rise of childhood neurological disorders. At present, growing attention is being directed towards the adverse role of aluminum adjuvants. Aluminum, under certain conditions, can and does indeed pass the blood-brain barrier and accumulate in certain brain regions. There is absolutely no safe level of aluminum in the brain. Professor Christopher Exley at Keele University in the United Kingdom is one of the world's leading scientists investigating aluminum's toxicity. He has already established in peer-reviewed literature that the heavy metal is a primary etiological factor in Alzheimer's disease. Exley also measured high levels of aluminum content in brain tissue of autistic children. In his paper entitled Aluminum in Brain Tissue and Autism, he notes that, quote, these are some of the highest values for aluminum in human body brain tissue yet recorded, end quote. The metal aluminum is especially prominent in inflammatory cells in the brain that may account for the common event of encephalitis observed in vaccine-injured children. Other research confirms Exley's findings. Dr. Roman Chrome Girardi at the University of Paris has mapped the translocation of vaccine aluminum in the brain of individuals susceptible to autism. Girardi and his colleagues describe alum particles as being linked to infectious viral components such as HIV and HCV, similar to a Trojan horse that makes their way into the brain. Research conducted Haim Siba Medical Center and Tel Aviv University in Israel, the University of Arkansas, and the University of British Columbia, four different medical centers, have also provided further evidence of aluminum's role in the development of chronic neuropathy. The role of environmental aluminum in triggering de novo mutations is also important. Unfortunately, this research is being completely ignored and, worse, denied by our federal health agencies and the medical establishment. Consequently, when a whistleblower at the CDC, Dr. William Thompson, produced irrefutable gold standard evidence that the CDC's own research confirmed that, yes, the MMR vaccine contributed to a sharp rise of 324% in autism among African-American boys under 3 years of age. He was institutionally ostracized. Thompson eventually drifted back into the quarters of the CDC, likely under a code of silence, and he has never been heard from again. But we have him on tape confessing this. But to our knowledge, he has never been denounced nor retracted any of the thousands of pages of documents he submitted to Congressperson Bill Posey and biology professor Brian Hooker that proved, absolutely proved, the CDC covered up vaccines' adverse effects, their association with autism, and the destroying of evidence. In conclusion, the current atmosphere of scientific denialism exhibited by the CDC and autism researchers, such as we believe Wendy Chung, about autism's etiology pervades medicine today. In such a climate, the autism rate will continue to rise, as enormous amounts of funding is wasted on chasing red herring, such as adding more genes to the national database without investigating the environmental factors, such as vaccination, that may cause these mutations. Furthermore, the testimonies of countless parents with vaccine-injured children must be given greater respect. These parents represent an enormous body of evidence that is categorically being swept under the rug in order for the draconian vaccine mandates to proceed as if there is no consequences. And since the nation's vaccine injury compensation is a rigged, fraudulent scam, and as the cost of health care increases while quality services decrease, families with autistic children that will demand a lifetime of care are being forced into destitution. In short, autism in America is an egregious national scandal. Attached to this article will be other scientific peer-reviewed literature showing the absolute connections between vaccination and different types of brain inflammation, including autism spectrum disorder. That is our response to what we feel was possibly a well-intentioned statement at a TED Talk by a highly respected person, but this person is not looking at the information that we have looked at. It will be posted later today on PRN.fm. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.